Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
The day when Washington waited to hear whether anyone in the White House would be indicted for leaking the name of an undercover CIA agent, the news instead was that White House counsel and close Bush confidant Harriet Myers withdrew her nomination to the Supreme Court. In a letter to the president, Myers said she was concerned that the confirmation process would be a burden for the White House because senators had requested internal documents about her role as White House counsel. The president reluctantly concurred in a letter of his own in which he praised Myers before leaving for hurricane-ravaged Florida. In Congress, there were few regrets. Former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott said, "Let's move on. In a month, who will remember the name Harriet Myers?" And Democrats such as Senator Charles Schumer of New Jersey bashed the president for caving in to social conservatives, who for a month now have either withheld support for Myers or actively campaigned against her.
If the president continues to listen to that extreme wing on judicial nominations or everything else, it can only spell trouble for his presidency and for America.
Well, joining us now with the latest on the Myers resignation or withdrawal is Maura Reynolds. She covers Congress for the Los Angeles Times. And Maura, quite a day to be there. What's it like on Capitol Hill?
Well, it's very exciting, actually. There's a great deal of relief on the Republican side and anxiety on the Democratic side, wondering what's going to come next.
Well, and the president says that this withdrawal was because of classified documents. Is that the thinking on the Hill?
Yes and no. I mean, there were a great number of things that all seemed to kind of coalesce yesterday that seemed to have led to this decision. What Harriet Myers said and what the White House spin on this morning is that she could tell that they were heading into an impasse with Republican supporters over documents, that Republicans were saying, like Democrats have said, and that they didn't know enough about her, they weren't sure about what her so-called judicial philosophy is, that they needed documentation, that documentation only could come from her service in the White House, and that she recognized that this was an impasse that was only going to get worse, and she decided to bow out before they reached a dead end. However, it does seem that they were swimming upstream with this nomination for quite a few days now, and try as hard as they might, that they just weren't gaining much ground, even with their own supporters.
Well, the documents were one thing, and many who felt that she wasn't a strict constitutionalist might have been in that camp, but then there were those who opposed her because they didn't feel that she had strong enough opinions about abortion. She did meet yesterday with the conservative group, the Concerned Women for America. We're going to be speaking to someone from that group, but do you think that was part of the tipping point?
It may have been. Actually, she didn't meet with them, but her former Senate advisor, Dan Coats, did meet with them, and they had been very concerned about her nomination for quite some time. The White House had put out this questionnaire that she filled out for Texas Right to Life in 1989, suggesting that she was very strongly anti-abortion, but then reading some of the text of her speeches in recent days, and including some media reports about them, she had come out and said that she thought that it was up to every individual woman to make their own decision, and that clearly was a contradiction that groups like Concerned Women for America were just not willing to tolerate.
And we're going to find out more about that, as I said, in just a couple of minutes. Maura Reynolds, a congressional correspondent for the L.A. Times, in Washington on a day when there's a big question mark over the city. Maura, thanks for speaking with us.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, it seems as if it was not just the nominee that was in question. It was the way the White House was presenting the nominee. What happened here? What went wrong? That's the headline of a recent piece from conservative columnist John Fund. He's editor of the Wall Street Journal's Opinion.com. He joins us now. And John, Myers may not have been the constitutionalist many conservatives wanted, but you wrote on Monday that you were sure that she would either withdraw or be defeated, in part because of how Bush allies were pushing the candidate behind the scenes. You list three approaches that his base did not like, the first being arm twisting.
Well, the White House, I think, miscalculated. They reacted badly to legitimate, principled, and philosophical concerns about Harriet Myers, who's a fine corporate lawyer but has no background in constitutional law, and they tried to intimidate some people, especially up in New Hampshire. They were sending messages to the future presidential candidates, you better vote for Harriet or you won't get any help from us. That backfired.
You also write that the White House attempted to rewrite the selection of Ms. Myers. Now, we know that Dr. James Dobson, the head of Focus on the Family, has said publicly that he was told things that he couldn't share by Karl Rove in particular. But you say that one of the things he was told was that any other female candidates had withdrawn.
Well, many others had withdrawn, and that's not true. The White House, I think, was trying to cover their tracks for not properly vetting Harriet Myers. After all, everyone knew Harriet. She'd worked in the White House for 5 years. Why put her through the vetting process? Well, it turned out that I think they found excuses to exclude many qualified female jurists, and they ended up with Harriet as the only person left standing.
Did you actually speak to some of the women that the White House reportedly said did not want to run because they were afraid of the vetting process?
Yes, and these are tough women, and they said, you know, we would have been willing to tell them bring it on.
This is obviously, these kinds of things were obviously affecting some of the members of the conservative base of George Bush.
Not just conservatives, people who really believe in a quality court in principle. Remember, conservatives aren't result-oriented. We don't want particular results out of the court. We want a process, a way of looking at legal cases through the lens of the Constitution and what the founders intended. And, you know, that's why, for example, many conservatives hate flag burning, but like Justice Scalia, they recognize the Constitution doesn't prohibit it. It's not result-oriented where wanted. And the problem with Harriet Myers is the president acted as if, I'm putting this woman on the court because I know how she'll vote. That's not right. That's not in our tradition.
Well, and finally, you say the White House just didn't provide documents. In fact, you took out your checkbook at one point.
I was joking. I said I would write a small check to anyone's favorite charity if they could prove to me that anyone has had a substantive philosophical or political conversation with Harriet Myers over the last 35 years. I was saying that to make a point that no one except the President of the United States has ever talked to this woman about these matters.
And there were literally, there was no paper trail.
There were op-eds and a couple of speeches which surfaced in the Washington Post yesterday, and those raised more questions and concerns than they cleared up.
These were that Harriet Myers had written. Well, John, you remind us that many conservatives have another nomination in mind, that of David Souter in 1990. He was seen, as you write, as a stealth nominee, you know, presented as conservative but too moderate for many. Current White House Chief of Staff Andy Card was behind the Souter nomination and also the Myers nomination. How are people responding to that?
Well, Andy is from Massachusetts. Andy is clearly a moderate Republican, although he's a very good Chief of Staff. He follows the President's wishes. But it is an exaggeration to say that he was behind the Souter nomination, but he certainly played a role 15 years ago under the first President Bush. And now he apparently was right in the middle of supporting this one, who frankly, now that we know more about her, was heading towards becoming a second Souter. And that's why I referred to Andy Card, that we were in danger of having him become a serial Souterizer.
Well, John, you also mentioned that there's another nomination that many conservatives are thinking of, and that is of Bernard Kerik, who was nominated by the president to head the Department of Homeland Security, a disastrous nomination when several scandals were revealed that came while Bernard Kerik headed the New York City Police Department. Is that in your mind now as you're watching Ms. Myers withdraw?
Well, I think the White House has to get a grip on its vetting process. People are under more scrutiny than they ever were. They're under more scrutiny than they were under Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton. And the White House has got to recognize that just because someone is a friend of the president's or a friend of Rudy Giuliani, who's an American hero, that doesn't mean that they're automatically the best person for the job. And I think the White House has been guilty of creating a perception that they can sometimes appoint cronies. That's got to end. This White House has 3 more years to go, and I think that now they've gotten a wake-up call to reorient their vetting process and their selection process.
John Fund of the Wall Street Journal, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, joining us now is Lanier Swan, Director of Government Relations with Concerned Women for America, one of the largest Christian advocacy groups in the country, and as we said, one that parsed this nomination. Lanier, your group had called for Myers' withdrawal. We read because of speeches that you'd found, one in which she was speaking to the executive women of Dallas and said, "The more I think about it, the more self-determination makes the most sense." What was your objection to her nomination?
Well, you know, the truth is we had objections on several levels. This speech was not the only thing. It was indeed something that raised troubling questions that were too deep and too significant to ignore. But that speech alone just created so much ambiguity in terms of where she would stand on so many different issues. You know, you saw that she covered a lot of different topics in that speech. It was quite lengthy. And of course, we saw in the Washington Post being excerpted, but then we were handed the speech in full and had time to really review it in context. And, you know, it just, she is somebody who, when you look back at her entire career, everything she's written and said and done, she is a woman who unfortunately displayed some shifting views, some blurry views, and at some time, no views at all.
Well, but your statement on her said that her speeches indicate a radical feminist worldview, a penchant for judicial activism, race and sex quotas, a liberal characterization of the abortion debate and government spending, and an inability to articulate her positions clearly. It's funny because we just heard from conservative columnist John Fund, who said conservatives are not goal-oriented, just sticklers for constitutional correctness. But it sounds as if you do want a nominee who will tell you what, that they will work to overturn Roe v. Wade? What is it you want now?
CWA has been very articulate in terms of what we would like to see on the bench. And that is exactly what President Bush has promised, a jurist in the same mold as Scalia or Thomas. And what that means essentially is someone who will strictly interpret the Constitution. It's exactly what Mr. Fund just said. We want someone who is a strict originalist, somebody who doesn't rule like a judicial activist, which is exactly what, unfortunately, we felt we were seeing in that speech. It was radically different from the meek, quiet Harriet Myers we had been hearing about. Suddenly, here she was quoting Gloria Steinem, Hillary Rodham Clinton. I mean, she was...
But, Lanier, I just want to get one quick last question in from you so we can get our last guest in here. Do you expect President Bush to give you that candidate now?
Well, we really trust the president. You know, we believe that he will follow through on his promise. He's heard from his base. He's heard from senators on both sides of the aisle, and I think he knows what's ahead of him and what's necessary to save our court.
Lanier Swan of Concerned Women for America, thank you.
Thank you.
And Ronald Cass joins us now. Well, he was one of the leaders of the Committee for Justice set up to support the president's nominees, and you've got to be disappointed today, Ron.
Well, I think that it's up to each candidate, each nominee, to decide whether she wants to go through the process or step away. Certainly, she stayed through an awful lot of criticism, and, you know, I commend her for what she put up with, and I commend her for her decision today. Certainly, you know, we expect the president to name someone who will, as John Fund said, be of a mind to interpret the Constitution according to its text and structure and history.
But Ronald Cass, does President Bush have a tough row to hoe here because he and Karl Rove and others said this was the best candidate? Doesn't any other candidate be the next best candidate?
Well, there are a lot of people that you look at when you look at a Supreme Court nomination. There are a lot of very highly qualified people there, a lot of smart people who bring different things to the nomination. Clearly, what the president was looking at in Harriet Myers wasn't exactly the same thing he was looking at in John Roberts. And, you know, each nomination he makes, he's looking at a set of characteristics that he thinks are appropriate to that particular nomination.
Ronald Cass of the Committee for Justice, we just have a few seconds. Is there also a tough row ahead because there's no opportunity for, I'm missing the word. I'm going to have to skip that point that I was going to make.
Whatever the word was, I agree.
Ronald Cass, thank you. And thank you for spending some time with us.
Certainly.
I'll remember the word. And when we come back, what's next? What is the White House facing now that they have to come up with a new nominee to replace Harriet Myers? Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Harriet Myers for nominee for the Supreme Court. The next question becomes, who will the White House pick? With conservatives claiming credit for derailing the nomination, some are speculating that the White House may need to cast its net further to the right to please its base. Gail Chadwick is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us now. And Gail, the word I was just searching for a moment ago, rather inarticulately, was filibuster. Now that there, you know, that the Republicans did not enact the nuclear option, the filibuster, they did not ban it. If President Bush, isn't there something sticky ahead? If President Bush does move to the right to please his base, that nominee may get filibustered.
That's exactly what's happening. It's, you know, it's very remarkable to see just in a few hours how quickly the rhetoric on both sides of this question has shifted. The president has faced for the last couple of weeks a fight he did not expect on his right. for ever since the Bork nomination, Republicans have been preparing a fight on the left for a Republican president's nominees. Well, now we're back on that terrain again. And very quickly you see Democrats coming out and establishing strong partisan lines that the right wing, you know, topple this nominee. They should not be rewarded. We need someone in the center and so forth. Otherwise, we'll filibuster.
Are there some names that are already being tossed about?
I think the name that Democrats are concerned about is someone like Michael Luttig, who would be a strong constitutional conservative scholar along the lines of possibly Robert Bork, or with the qualifications of a John Roberts. They don't want to see another strong conservative voice on the court. And that was part of the internal debate in the party. How strongly should they oppose Harriet Myers? Because the next nominee, should she be toppled, could be much worse.
Well, in fact,
that's
we have,
what they're looking at.
Yeah, in fact, we have Ralph Neese with us. He's president of People for the American Way, the liberal advocacy group. Ralph, welcome.
Hi, Robin. Hi, Gail.
Hi. And your group had held back and not taken a stand on Myers. You said you were going to wait until the hearings to take a position. Now that you've seen the role that conservatives seem to have played, your thoughts?
Well, we certainly did not take a position. We wanted to hear Harriet Myers at the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings and try to determine what her judicial philosophy would be and whether or not she would be independent. What happened today, I think, was just an abject and total capitulation to the right wing. I've been privileged to have worked on a dozen Supreme Court nominations since my days as Republican counsel to Senator Edward W. Brooke. I've never seen anything like this. This is an astonishing spectacle, and I think it does underscore how the ultra-conservative wing of the Republican Party dominates politically. And basically, they have been pummeling the president for the last several weeks. They've really pounded him into submission, and they've dictated the withdrawal of Harriet Myers.
Well, Gail, let's bring some other thoughts in here, because they would say, and have been saying on right-wing radio for weeks now, they deserve this. They put him in office.
And they put him in office mainly on judicial nominations. There were many points at which the conservative base wanted this president to take a stronger position on social issues, and always, or on the size of government, or on cutting spending, or on the deficit. And the answer always was, wait, because what's important here is the judicial fight. That's why the nomination of someone without a proven track record as a movement conservative, and with the appearance of cronyism to boot, was such a blow to this group. What's interesting to me in following this is what's happened to the money. As I spoke with people this morning, it looks to me as if the money for selling this nomination from big Republican donors simply dried up. And that explains a lot of the ads that never materialized and the absence of the kind of selling effort that has gone on for John Roberts, and we fully expected for this nominee as well.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because David Keene, who's head of the American Conservative Union, which, as its name suggests, is a conservative advocacy group, wrote recently in a piece to fellow conservatives that they had, quote, swallowed policies they opposed out of loyalty to Bush, and said no more. From now on, this administration will find it difficult to muster support on the right without explaining why it should be forthcoming. The days of the blank check have ended.
Oh, you see that especially going on in Congress right now with the fight over the budget. Movement conservatives have woken up, both in the House and the Senate, and it's going to be a lot tougher for this president. And we haven't even talked about the indictments that may be coming down tomorrow.
Mm. Well, Gail, in the meantime, and while we have you, Washington still waits to hear the results of the Fitzgerald investigation into the outing of CIA agent Plame. Many thought that would be the news today. It feels as if we might have heard today an early response to the possible indictment of a White House aide, Scooter Libby. Uber-conservative Ann Coulter this morning on the Today Show said, Scooter who? She said, I've never heard his name till about 10 minutes ago, which would some to seem unlikely. He played such a pivotal role in the White House. Is the White House, while the Myers withdrawal is going on, also gearing up to sort of distance themselves from people who may be at the center of that indictment?
Well, that is, of course, the huge question right now. One of the things that the withdrawal of this nominee does is give the president a card he didn't have before, which is a way to dramatically change the subject, or at least give reporters something else to talk about. If another name comes up, there will be immediate coverage of that as well. It's not clear. You know, I was hearing commentators this morning say that that the indictments will trump any Supreme Court nomination. It'll be interesting to see whether that's the case. The Supreme Court is a lifetime appointment. This is the pivotal seat. It's a very high, intense issue for many people. And I think that if the president is able to divert attention, even to a small degree, from what's going on inside his own White House, it gives him another talking point. This is a president that is as embattled as any we've seen in a second term. It's going to be a great challenge to move ahead, especially if his most trusted advisors are themselves caught up in this.
That's Gail Chadwick. She's a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. We also spoke with Ralph Nies, president of People for the American Way, on this day where Harriet Myers has withdrawn her nomination for the Supreme Court, and we are looking to the future. Thank you both for helping us do that.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from Mission to Harriet Myers' withdrawal of her Supreme Court nomination. The Bush administration is facing other challenges on the legal front today, including the policy of indefinite detainment of terror suspects. First, dirty bomb suspect Jose Padilla today asked the Supreme Court to decide how long the government can jail people in military prisons. Padilla, an American convert to Islam, has been in custody for more than 3 years. And a federal judge yesterday called allegations of forced feedings of detainees at Guantanamo Bay who are on a hunger strike deeply troubling, and that judge ordered the government to turn over their recent medical records. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is attorney Tom Wilner, who represents 11 Kuwaiti men being held at Guantanamo, including one detainee who's been on a hunger strike since August and wants his feeding tube removed. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And first to the Padilla case, what are his lawyers asking and what are the chances of success?
The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in September ruled against Padilla. They ruled that the United States has the right to detain someone who was a U.S. citizen picked up on American soil. And what the Padilla lawyers are really asking for is the Supreme Court to review that case, that decision.
So we'll wait and see if the Supreme Court does take that up.
Yeah, the Supreme Court is not required, and the appeal is not automatic.
Well, and now to this ruling yesterday from Judge Gladys Kessler, which affects many of your clients. Many Americans may be surprised to learn that there is a hunger strike going on at Guantanamo, but you represent some of the detainees there, correct?
Yes, I do.
And there's been an ongoing issue over the forced feeding of these hunger strikers. Now, the judge has ruled that lawyers defending these detainees on hunger strike must be notified before their clients are forced fed, and that lawyers must see their medical records. So how directly does this affect you?
Well, we had a case that was won before the Supreme Court last June, which said that these detainees at Guantanamo have the right to go to court to challenge the basis of their detention. Since that time, there have now been 50 separate cases filed, and there are about 10 judges deciding these issues. Judge Kessler is one of those judges. People have recently gone on hunger strike in Guantanamo basically because of the hopelessness of their situation. Although we've had cases pending before the courts for 3.5 years, they have gotten no relief, and they've never had a hearing, and they're going on hunger strike out of frustration. About 20 to 30 are being force-fed through tubes, and we don't even know how they're being treated or what their medical conditions are. Judge Kessler, in one of the cases, said that the lawyers and their families are at least entitled to medical reports on their conditions.
Now, Judge Kessler, as you said, is just one of the judges looking at these Guantanamo Bay suits. Your case is before another judge, but does her ruling affect you at all?
I'm hoping that Judge Kessler's ruling and the wisdom of it will influence our judge also to allow us to get the medical records and the status reports on the health of our people who are starving themselves to death.
Well, let's talk about that, because you have one client in particular who is on a hunger strike. He has a feeding tube, and he wants his feeding tube removed?
That's exactly right. He asked us to petition the court to to stop the government from force-feeding him so that he could die. We told him that we felt uncomfortable doing that, at least in his present condition, because he hasn't been able to talk to his parents, not talk to them at all, for 4 years. He hasn't had access to any independent doctor who represents him rather than the government.
And by the way, that's one of the things that you are asking, is that there be family contact. The government, the U.S. government, saying that they fear that messages might be sent back and forth if there was contact.
That's right. And what we have said is, look, it's absolutely essential, because of his condition now, his depression, that he get to talk to his parents. And we say, if there's any security issues, we can have the whole government on the line with an on-off switch.
And by the way, you have another problem potentially, because the family in Kuwait does not want their son's tube removed, and that gives you a sort of a legal pickle.
Yeah, it's we are in a difficult position. The parents, whom we also represent, clearly want him kept alive, frankly, as do I. And if he asks us then to petition to allow him to die, we are in a conflict with the parents, and we'll need to resolve that at the time.
And by the way, we should say you believe that your client is innocent of any charges, that he's done nothing wrong.
Well, he claims he has done nothing wrong, as do my other clients. The key issue is that they have absolutely never had a hearing to determine that. The government has never even alleged or made any designation that it believes these people were connected with terrorism. I do believe he's innocent, but I know darn well that he should be entitled to some tribunal where he can prove his innocence.
And by the way, regarding the feeding tubes, the U.S. military says that hunger striking is a form of suicide, and that they have a policy and an obligation to prevent detainees from killing themselves, harming themselves through a hunger strike. That's why they say they have the right to put the feeding tubes in. Have you seen this client? How bad is he?
I have seen him twice since he's been on force feeding. He has continued to lose weight. He is skin and bones now. When I interviewed him the last time, he has a tube in his nose all the time. He was bleeding intermittently from his nose. Let me say another thing. I want these people kept alive now. I don't want to press that he be allowed to die, although he may force us to do that. But if the government force feeds them, it's got to do it in a humane way and an effective way.
Tom, this comes as there is related news that Vice President Dick Cheney secretly pushed for a measure that would allow CIA operatives to harshly interrogate foreign suspects detained abroad. John McCain had written legislation with an outright ban of torture. Cheney is reported to have asked McCain to exclude the CIA from that ban. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, let's call it what it is. What Cheney really pushed for is that we be allowed to torture, the CIA be allowed to torture captives abroad. And I think that's
because of the war on terrorism, because of the need.
First of all, every expert I've talked to says that torture doesn't work as a means of interrogation. Secondly, it really, we're not talking about somebody who's down there with ticking bomb information in most of these places. You just don't have that.
You need somebody who may know when a bomb is about to go off somewhere.
Yeah, people tell me that is almost never the case, and it's certainly not the case of anyone in Guantanamo who have been there, you know, 4 years, or anyone in Abu Ghraib who were there. The important point of this is most of those people are innocent, or at least have never had a hearing to prove whether they're innocent or not.
And Tom Wilner, I got to ask you one last question, since this is an important news day in other ways. As we see the withdrawal of the nomination of Harriet Myers, you've had cases before the Supreme Court, may have more with your representation of detainees. And there are all sorts of questions as to what happens next. If Sandra Day O'Connor, for instance, is sitting on cases, the Padilla case, for instance, if they take it, and then leaves the bench when a nomination comes. I mean, this unsettled nature of the court, how does that affect your cases currently?
Well, it could clearly affect it. Sandra Day O'Connor was a critical vote. She voted for us in our case on Guantanamo, and she wrote the opinion in the Hamdi case, which involved detention of American citizens. The key thing about Justice O'Connor, as I said, that she took seriously the responsibility of an independent judiciary, independent from the executive branch, from the president, willing to question the decisions of the executive branch. We need somebody who's willing to do that. That's what the court is supposed to do.
Tom Wilner represents 11 Kuwaiti men being held at the detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He's a partner in the Washington law firm Shearman and Sterling. Tom, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
And don't forget, in a couple minutes, we're going to the museum with George Lucas.
You're listening to Here and Now. The sounds of exhilarated Chicago White Sox fans celebrating at Minute Maid Park in Houston last night after 88 years of trying, not the same team, of course, but the White Sox finally won the World Series. They swept the Houston Astros, winning 1-0 and erasing, at least for the moment, memories of the 1919 Black Sox scandal. Here to wrap up the series, talk about some news in the world of women's basketball as well, of course. Only a game home is Bill Littlefield. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, you know, I guess we here in Boston can take consolation in the fact that the team that beat our Red Sox went on to win the whole thing, and they have Sox in their name.
Absolutely. Spelled the same way, too.
But, you know, and it was kind of fun to listen as everybody talked about the Sox winning. I just kept thinking, well, it's us. I'm not going to pay any attention. But it was the White Sox, finally. You like this result?
Well, I like this result for lots of reasons. I'd like it even more if you hadn't qualified the introduction. What if it was the same team and we'd have some guy saying, I knew we'd win if we only kept trying. anyway, yeah, if you like the Red Sox winning after all those years last fall, you have to like the White Sox winning this fall after all those years. So that's kind of fun. And the other thing is that they managed to put together that kind of magical combination that sometimes happens for a team. Pretty good hitting, great pitching, and all the luck in the world. Everything their manager tried to do worked, and all the calls, almost all the calls that they needed to get, whether they were dropped third strikes or pitches that hit bats, but umpires thought they hit people, that sort of stuff. They all broke their way, and it was great.
Is Babe Ruth over there or something?
No, I think this, but can we put that, you know, behind us finally after last fall?
But, you know, you have to feel for the Houston Astros because it had been 44 years for them in the entire life of the team franchise. They hadn't won. You had Roger Clemens, you know, a glorious career. So people said, as you said, it would be pitching that would determine the outcome. How'd everybody do?
Well, it was pitching, especially last night. But there were all kinds of wonderful things that happened. I don't think anybody was disappointed with the pitching except, of course, Roger Clemens fans. They only got to see him for two innings in the World Series because he pulled a hamstring or re-aggravated a hamstring injury and left very early in that first game. But otherwise, yeah, it was a pitching series, and it was great fun to watch, and it was as dramatic as a sweep can be, which is, how about that for a qualification?
Right. Well, congratulations to our White Sox fans. But I know it's hard for them to believe. There were other sports news in the sporting world today in an area that we know is near and dear to you, Bill, which is women's basketball, women's anything, soccer as well. But Cheryl Swoops of the Houston Comets, a three-time WNBA Most Valuable Player, Olympic gold medalist, announced in ESPN The Magazine that she is a lesbian. Now, she says most of her teammates either knew already or knew and didn't want to know. Is this a groundbreaking moment in women's sports? What is this?
Well, I don't think it's groundbreaking because the WNBA is the league in which active players have previously announced that they're gay. Sue Wicks, for example, and a couple of others as well. So it's groundbreaking in the sense that none of them has the kind of high profile that Cheryl Swoops has. It will be very interesting to see what happens next, you know, whether other players follow suit. I think the one thing you can say about this league is she doesn't really have to worry about the reaction of people who follow the league, you know, people who come to the games.
Well, Swoops has been in a long-term relationship with an assistant coach for the Comets, and she said that before it happened to her, she might have thought that a relationship between a player and a coach might be an ethical problem, regardless of the gender. You know, is that going to be an issue?
I think that what she's saying is definitely true in the sense that any relationship where the power is on one side, I mean, a professor and a student, for example, is a bad idea, the same way that a coach and a player is a bad idea. Much less true in the WNBA, where a three-time MVP, a woman who's won to the championships and the acclaim that Cheryl Swoops has won, is going to have more power than an assistant coach on the Houston Comets. So, you know, it's a little bit different.
It still feels as if we've come a long way from, I remember in the early 80s, interviewing Martina Navratilova on the Today Show when it had just come out in the newspapers that she was gay. And the look in her eyes, please don't ask me, please, and I didn't. Mm-hmm. But the fear, it feels as if we've come a long way from that.
Well, I think so. Cheryl Swoops has gotten an endorsement contract for cruises that appeal to gay customers coming at the same time as the announcement. So this was Martina's greatest fear, of course. She'd lose endorsements.
Basketball and baseball with only a game host, Bill Littlefield. And for all you White Sox fans out there, let's give them just a few more seconds of celebrating, shall we? You're listening to Here and Now. big news story of the day so far, Harriet Meyer's withdrawal of her nomination to the Supreme Court. This morning in the Oval Office, President Bush accepted Meyer's withdrawal reluctantly. That was after Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist spoke with White House Chief of Staff Andy Card last night and offered what Frist called a frank assessment of the prospects for the nomination in the full Senate. Since her October 3rd nomination, social conservatives have expressed their concern about Meyer's lack of a record on matters such as abortion. This morning, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, who suggested Meyer as a candidate to the White House, blasted the president for caving in to conservatives.
I hope our president, the President of the United States, in choosing a replacement for his lawyer, and that's what she is, won't reward the bad behavior of this right-wing base.
Senator Frist says he expects a replacement Supreme Court nominee within days. And concerning the other story that's gripped Washington for weeks, the investigation into who leaked the name of undercover CIA agent Valerie Plame. A spokesperson for the special prosecutor in the case said there would be no public announcements today. The term of the grand jury that could bring indictments of top White House aides expires tomorrow. Well, now for something totally different.
Welcome aboard the Millennium Falcon. I'm Anthony Daniels. You probably know me better as C-3PO Human Cyborg Relations.
Recently, we lived out the fantasy of millions of Star Wars fans with a ride on Han's solo ship, the fastest hunk of junk in the galaxy, the Millennium Falcon.
Now, everyone, please brace yourselves because we're about to make the jump to light speed.
Hang on.
The Falcon is the main attraction of the new $5 million exhibit, Star Wars, Where Science Meets the Imagination, opening at Boston's Museum of Science today. And how lucky were we? Well, we got our private preview with Star Wars creator George Lucas, who was seeing the exhibit for the first time.
It really is fantastic because it takes areas of the imagination and shows how once you think of something, you can work to make it real. I think that's really important for especially young people to think outside what actually is possible.
That's been George Lucas's filmmaking style as well, thinking of an image and then asking engineers to create it for him. The films, in turn, have inspired a generation of scientists, and so it's fitting that his science fiction now stands alongside science fact. Exhibit planner Ed Rodley began the tour.
We're looking at transportation and robotics, specifically the way that robots and people get along together, because we wanted to try to pick technologies that are well represented in all six films. Technologies that are well represented here on the real world.
The real world displays come from institutions such as MIT and NASA, and for the first time, George Lucas provided props and costumes from all six movies. So we came face to face with Wookiees, androids like R2-D2 and C-3PO, and Darth Vader. And then there were the Star Wars gadgets.
This is the original land speeder from 1977.
It's a wreck. It's really beat up.
It is. It's got all kinds of huge dents on it. It looks like Luke was probably not the most careful driver, like many young people in rural areas who have old cars.
In rural outer space?
Well, it's like a two-seater hot rod with three jet engines on the back. It's actually an English three-wheel car underneath that they ripped the body off of and built this futuristic-looking sort of bullet-shaped two-seater on top of. We really wanted to try to use Star Wars as a way to get people halfway along in thinking about, well, what could our future really be like?
Well, Star Wars was originally one of the main purposes of it was to sort of stretch the imagination of young people,
right,
and get them to think outside the box,
right,
and to sort of say, well, this is all more than I could imagine, but now I can imagine things like this, but actually other people have imagined it and actually made it work.
So let's move on and look at spaceships.
These exhibits repeatedly show how today's scientists have been making Star Wars fantasy into reality. For instance, in Star Wars, Luke lost a hand. Well, he had it replaced with an artificial one, and here there are several examples of implants and prosthetics. In the first movie, Luke trained with his lightsaber by sparring with a small hovering robot. Well, NASA took that concept to the next level.
Remember, a Jedi can feel the Force flowing through him.
the idea is basically it's something to assist astronauts aboard the space station.
Right.
They would just hover around behind your head. It's got a bunch of sensors, so it can just prowl the halls and note if there are any oxygen leaks or temperature fluctuations.
The real R2-D2.
Do you think you'll be working with robots someday that can think, that have a heart?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've passed the level of Star Wars already. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, and the robots that are as smart as 3PO, I dare say, and are even more sophisticated socially than he is. That is not to say they have a heart. The heart really is in the programmer.
What are some of the other things in the early Star Wars that, as a filmmaker, you dreamed of it, but it hadn't come yet?
Well, practically everything. I mean, it was the original Star Wars was designed very carefully around the technology because I knew what I could and couldn't do and what the limits were. And one of the big advances that I had to accomplish in order to make that movie was to be able to pan with spaceships, something that seems very simple, but it was very, very hard and impossible at that point. We had to sort of take special effects, which was models and animation, and that gave us the kinetic speed and energy visually that you need to make Star Wars work. And we couldn't do creatures. They'd be foam rubber puppets or heads that we put on top of people. But now, you know, once we moved into the world of digital technology, everything was possible. I've never been that good at math and science and the more academic side of the imagination. And I think one of the advantages some people have, like myself, that maybe aren't as good at the actual science of things, is to be able to say, well, why can't you just do that? And, of course, everybody sits there and scratches their head and says, you know, we never thought of that. It's too obvious.
So you may not have been the science and math whiz, but you have inspired so many. But I'm wondering, given that Star Wars has inspired so many, why isn't this country doing better in science? And maybe do you hope that something like this will change that?
Yeah, I think a program like this is extremely good because what it does is it connects what you do in class if you don't like science, which is daydream, to what actually is going on in the science class, which is science. And you realize that those things are not disconnected.
So people are wondering, what are you dreaming of now?
I'm working on what we call a previs system, which is a way of making movies in a computer and doing it very, very easily so anybody can do it. You just take your actors, you build your set, and then you move around and you shoot the movie just like you would a real movie. We're doing an animated TV show first, which we're working on right now, which is called Clone Wars, and then we're going to do another live-action TV show. And what we're doing is we're reinventing how we do special effects.
Would you ever go back to, you know, the American Graffiti, a guy, a girl, another guy, and a car?
That's what Star Wars is, just a guy and a girl and another guy and a spaceship. Ultimately, movies are about people. They're not about technology, and they're not about special effects, and they're not about gadgets. They're about people. That's what people relate to.
Fun day. Our tour with George Lucas at Boston's Museum of Science, where he also told us, by the way, that Harrison Ford has signed up for his new anxiously awaited Indiana Jones movie, but that probably won't hit theaters until 2007. In the meantime, Star Wars, where science meets imagination, will be on display at Boston's Museum of Science through April. Then it will go on the road for at least 2 years. And this note, earlier we beamed Senator Charles Schumer to New Jersey. He is, of course, the senator from New York. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.